What is going on, everybody? Welcome to A Theology of Hustle. I'm your host, Curry Blanford, and today I'm talking to Tori Hope Peterson. So I found Tori via Instagram. She has an amazing Instagram account, just talking about foster care. She's a former foster youth, is a foster care advocate now, and just does like some incredible stuff, has an awesome blog, all that stuff. So you should be following her on Instagram for sure, following her blog and all that. And so in this episode, we just get into some of the intricacies of what foster care are. I think a lot of times people don't even sort of understand how foster care works, all of that stuff. Maybe some of the statistics around foster care. I think people should definitely know, and we get into that here. We also get into talking about Tori's birth mother, and it's a powerful story, y'all. There's a lot of brokenness in this story, and there's a lot of beauty at the same time. And so, man, I can't wait for you to hear from her and hear how God has shaped her story to do what she does today in amazing ways. And yeah, it's a beautiful episode. Before we get to the episode, you can make sure and follow me on Instagram and Facebook at Theology of Hustle, and on Twitter at Curry Blanford to stay up to date with the podcast and what's going on. We got some great things sort of rolling out here. So I'm excited to share those with you. So make sure you're staying up to date. You can also check out Tori at the Replanted Ministry free online conference coming up here in October. It's awesome. Check it out. So many good speakers there about adoption and foster care stuff. So make sure and check that out and enjoy hearing from Tori. Well, Tori, I can't say thanks enough for coming on the podcast and chatting with me a little bit. It's super fun.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Oh, for sure. For sure. I can't wait to talk about all the things. So how about we get started and just have you maybe just introduce yourself a little bit to everybody.
Great. My name is Tori Peterson, and I live in Albert Lea, Minnesota with my husband, my 20-month-old son, and I'm also 30 weeks pregnant with a girl.
Nice. Congrats.
Thank you. I do foster care advocacy on social media, in my community, and wherever people ask me. I'm a national speaker and a writer, and I try to communicate foster care and adoption in light of the gospel, and I try to share my life very vulnerable with people. I think oftentimes people share the hard times after the fact, and so I want to share the hard times while we're in the midst of them, because that's when we need someone to say that we're not alone.
Yeah. No, I think that's good. And those stories, yeah, it's always easy to tell a story when it's sort of wrapped up nice and neat, right? It's much more difficult when you're walking through it still, and there's unknown still, I guess, you know?
So, yeah, for sure.
I love that. Okay, maybe we should jump through, like sort of walk through your story a little bit, if that's okay.
Yeah.
I just, whatever you feel comfortable sharing, you know, all of the disclaimers and all that stuff. But I just love to know, I mean, there's a reason you're a foster care advocate, right? So do you mind just sort of sharing how you even like got there?
Yeah, so I grew up in and out of the foster care system. I grew up in Ohio, and my mom and her boyfriend, they were drug lords. So I was taken out of the home when I was 4 years old. I was an only child at the time. And I think I spent 6 months in the foster care system. You know, you don't really have a context for like what time is
right
when you're 4 years old.
Yeah.
But I think my mom said it was about 6 months. And then because the goal of foster care is reunification, I was reunified with my mom.
Right.
And then I lived with her until I was a preteen. And my mom birthed my sister, who is 10 years younger than me at the time. And so then when I was a preteen, my sister and I were taken out of her home again, and we were placed together in our first foster home. But then after probably 2 or 3 weeks, I was taken out of that home after reporting abuse that had happened, and I was called a liar. I was told that it didn't happen. It was kind of brushed under the rug. There were a lot of kids in the home, and so I imagine that it would have been really hard to replace all of those youth in right one night. And it was, I think the foster home was looked at, you know, as this foster home that would kind of take any kid. So mm-hmm. It was like, how can we get rid of this one? This out of all the homes, we can't get rid of this one. So I was taken out of that home. Me and my sister were separated, which was one of the hardest things I've ever endured until this very day. And then I moved throughout 12 different foster homes until I emancipated when I turned 18 years old. And I was never, so in the fall, while I was in the foster care system, never found a forever home, never found a forever family. After I emancipated, I was bouncing around from home to home, people within my church and my community. And I had come to Christ in the midst of all of this turmoil. And there were two things that brought me to him. The first, giving a little background, I was really bitter that I didn't have a father. You know, you hear about the Freudian complex all the time. Like, yeah. If a teenage girl has issues, or if a woman has issues, it's because she has daddy issues. People don't consider, like, that I might have had mommy issues. My mom was diagnosed with bipolar and schizophrenia, so that was very likely. And people don't really, I felt like people didn't really talk about the effects that the foster care system could have had on me. It was just, oh, she has an absent father. So it's just, it has to be daddy issues. So it was really bitter. I was like, ugh, I don't have a dad. And if I did have a dad, then all my problems would be solved. And if there was a really good God, why wouldn't he give me a dad? And then the second part of that was, if there was a really good God, he's loving, then why am I myself and all of these other young people, why do we endure such suffering at the hands of our parents? And I kept going to church. I kept reading books. And I kept praying. And I don't know why I did all those things, because I really would say I didn't. I had to believe in something, but I don't think it wasn't the gospel. So then it was just like this realization. There were two things: that God was my father, that he loved me and protected me better than an earthly father ever could have. And the second thing was that we were made in God's image. And if we're meant to reflect Jesus, right? Like, Jesus came down, lived an earthly life so that he could be a model to us, and so that we can know how to live. And his greatest glory was found in suffering. So if we're meant to reflect God, and if we're meant to glorify God, then oftentimes that's going to be in suffering.
Yeah.
And so God really just penetrated my heart. I just fell in love with him. And it was like I surrendered the dad thing to him. I surrendered a lot to him. I was like, I just want my life. I want my story to be yours. Tell me how to use it. And about a month later, after I'm bouncing around from home to home, I'm homeless. I'm really homeless. My track coach comes to me and he says, you can be a part of our family. After track season is over, after you graduate, because we got to avoid all the technicalities and legalities with the school, you can move in with my family and you can be a part of us. You can come back for the holidays when you go to college. And that's what I did. And he's the man who walked me down the aisle. He's the man who I would consider my father. And I feel like, because I just said, God, you're my father, I'm surrendering this idea to you, it was like, now I'm going to give it. Now I'm going to give it to you, because you see the value in it. And you also see the truth of who I am.
Yeah. Whew. I'm already getting teared up here, Tori. I was already feeling the feels from reading through your blog anyway. So, but, it's just, that's such a beautiful story, you know. Deep pain involved, you know, and at the same time, like, God's glory, you know. And I think that's important and beautiful. So yeah, because I even notice on your social media and your blog and stuff, you're very intentional about saying Abba, you know. Do you mind talking a little bit just about that?
Yeah, so my favorite author, someone who's just had a huge impact on My faith walk is Brennan Manning. He's a Christian author, and he writes a book called The Furious Longing of God. And his most famous book, I think, is called Abba's Child. And he just really drives home the point that we, as people, we're really lost. We're really empty, you know, just all of these very true things. But because we have this father, this dad in heaven, who offers us a kingdom, right? Like, we inherit a kingdom from a king. The greatest privilege that we receive through the gospel is adoption. And he's our daddy. And it's just such this, that word Abba just, it exemplifies how intimate of a relationship God actually wants with us, how intimate of a relationship we can truly have with him if we seek it. And I think, as someone who really grew up without a father, who grew up with parents that weren't very parenting, when I think of God as this parent, this person who guides me, sometimes in ways that are difficult, like with discipline, like a parent does.
Yeah.
But also in very loving ways, I feel like I just see him for who he is, and I feel like I see myself for who he's made me to be.
It's awesome. Thank God. If everybody could only see themselves in that light, right? Like, I think that's such an important part of it all. It's good. Okay, so let's. You know what? I was just reading your blog post about your birth mother. I think that's an important part that gets missed in some of this, you know, is just, the birth parents, right? And like, they get vilified and, they're seen as, you know, less than, and like, even when you're in foster care situations, like, the foster parents can sometimes just be working against birth parents, you know, thinking it's better for the child to be away. You know, can you just talk about how you sort of contextualized your relationship with your birth mother now and some of that?
Yeah. So my mom, I view my mom as a hero, even though there's been a lot of adversity. Like, my mom would, obviously there's physical abuse in the home. That's what eventually took me out of the home that second time. But I would say the most damaging thing that my mom ever did was her words. Because she was diagnosed with bipolar and schizophrenia, she was very volatile. And when she was in her fits of mania, she just said really, really mean things. But as time has went on, there have been two things that I feel like have allowed me to really see my mom for who she is. The first thing is that I was conceived out of rape. So my mom had a really hard decision to make. And many women, and many people just in general, say that is a great reason to abort a child. But my mom chose life for me. And she said she saw my hands under my head on the ultrasound. She heard my heart beating. And she always said, she always told me the story growing up. She was like, I knew when I heard your heartbeat, when I saw you on that ultrasound, that I loved you.
Mm-hmm.
And I do know that my mom loves me. I think that many people think that, oh, because your mom, like, she abandoned you. She didn't abandon me. I don't feel that way. I don't feel like my mom abandoned me. Or because she was so harsh, you must feel like she doesn't love you. And I don't feel that way. I think my mom told me she loved me all the time. I think she showed it through that very difficult decision she made. And the second thing was, I lived in a group home. After I moved out of that first foster home, during the second time I was taken into care, I went to a residential group home, and there was 9 other girls who lived in the home. And still today, the description of the group home says something along the lines of, we help young women and men work through like mental problems and mental and emotional problems and behaviors. And I had never been diagnosed with a mental illness, nor did I have any behaviors that were any different than like your regular teenager. Right. So when I got there, I was pretty bitter. I was pretty upset that I was there. And I was like, I probably thought the same thing that every other kid thought. I was like, I do not belong here. And living with 9 other girls who they did have much more dramatic behaviors than I did. But it really opened my eyes to the idea, right, that we hear all the time, hurt people hurt people.
Yeah.
And I was going to counseling at the time. At the group home, every child was required to go to counseling once a week on the campus that we lived at. And then I was living with these 9 young women and just watching them. And it was almost like, in hearing their stories, it was almost like the worst of what they endured, the worse their behaviors were. Mm. And I think it just really allowed me to see my mom differently because I was working through my own trauma. And I was seeing how I had hurt people myself. I was seeing these girls work through their trauma, and there was this realization that yes, hurt people, but heal people, heal people. Mm, and I could either see my mom in the light of this like dark person who makes bad choices and all of these things, or I could see her and I could help be a part of this like healing process, and I could love her well. I could see her as who she is. She's someone who wants to be good and loving and kind. She showed that, but she has this mental illness that is just overtaking her. She has a chemical imbalance that she can't control. And if I can be a part of a good part of the healing of that, of the love in her life, then that's what I want to be.
Yeah, for sure. So you were putting that together in high school when you were sort of like realizing all of that?
I mean, I would say it's been a pretty long process, yeah. But yeah, those girls really opened my eyes to so much. I mean, I lived with them for almost a year and a half. And it was the first time I had ever attended counseling, which made a huge difference. I had a good counselor too.
Yeah.
So, and I think those can be hard to find.
Agreed. Yes.
So, yeah, I think just it was this perfect combination that allowed me to see all these things. And again, this, why did I go to church? I don't know. But every week I went to church. And I think there was probably something there too, where I was just hearing these messages of forgiveness, hearing these messages of healing and hope. I'm absolutely sure the spirit had a lot to do with it. I just didn't know that what he was, who he was, and what he was doing.
Yeah. Yeah. So much so. I feel like, especially with people with mental illness, right. Or that, you know, like lose children, you know, because of abuse or something, like our society just has like no grace for them. Those, you know, it's just like, oh, you did something wrong. You were, you know, sort of worthless and undeserving of good things. And you're like, even Christians, you're like, you serve a God who like grace upon grace, and yet you can't have grace for other people. That doesn't mean that like you don't, you know, that you don't, you know, do take proper steps to like keep the children safe and that sort of thing. Right. Like, or, you know, but, to just have grace, like, you know, your mom endured, I'm sure, all sorts of difficult things in her life, you know, and to not have any grace for that is just astounding to me. So,
yeah, that's been something I've been thinking about a lot lately. But for me, it's so easy to have grace for the hurting. it's so easy to have grace for the underprivileged, the suffering, the marginalized. And as I've been thinking about this, like, God's love, it extends to all, and his grace is never ending. I've asked myself, who do I struggle to love? Like, who do I struggle to extend mercy and grace to? And my pastor, he did a sermon one time, and he said, the people who give the most mercy, like, that might be their strength, but their weakness is that they struggle to give mercy to those who struggle to give mercy. And I've just realized recently that I really struggle to love, extend mercy and grace to those who don't look like my mom, to those who might be very privileged, to those who might have a lot of fortune. And that's been something that I've been trying to work on, because if we say that love extends to the mom who didn't choose abortion, who struggles with mental illness, who abused her daughter, well, then his love also extends to the rich and the people who extend their privileges to the privileged, the people who look different than the people I grew up with.
Yeah. Yeah, it can be really easy to get in that other sort of mode of thinking, right? Or get into that mode of thinking where, like, oh, you have privilege and you don't, you, yeah. There can be so many things
there.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, those are always the hard, I think looking to the people that you struggle with most and, like, seeing how you can have grace for them, I think is really wise and horribly difficult, you know? Yeah, that's good stuff. Okay. So let's talk foster care advocacy then, because I love what you got going. It's awesome. I think it's an important topic, and voices like yours aren't listened to enough in this world. I just, like, you're the one that has, like, lived through it. And, I feel like adoptive and foster families don't listen to sort of former foster youth and adult adoptees like they should, you know? So,
yeah, it's definitely, I would say right now in our culture today, it's foster parents and especially foster moms who have the big platform and who are listened to. So that's why I'm here.
Yeah, I love
I'm here.
Yeah. Thanks for using your voice. I appreciate that. I think it's very important. So let's talk, like, what does foster care advocacy even look like? I assume there's probably listeners out there that have no concept of the foster care system, like, in general, you know? So.
Yeah. So what does foster care advocacy look like? I'll tell you where I started. Okay.
Yeah. I'd love that.
So I was 16, still in the foster care system, and a nonprofit called Children's Lantern. Their realm of work was foster care, adoption, and human trafficking. So they chose three people who had actually been through those things. And then they were having a fundraiser and they said, will you write a sign out of, like, something you want to tell people? And we then stood on the stage. We just held our signs and it was just silent. And we held them for a really long time as people walked by. And so it's kind of a somber, very somber environment. But on my sign, I wrote, stop stereotyping me. And all of us had different things that we wrote on our signs. But I would say that was probably, like, my first form of advocacy. I was speaking for myself, and I hope that I was speaking for the foster youth who came after me. And I think that's what advocacy is all about. That's what I keep in mind. I just keep in mind all of the foster youth who are coming after me. And so I think advocacy I feel like I do it all the time. So sometimes it looks like just having that one-on-one conversation with the mom who is infertile and who wants to know more about foster care and adoption as like she's viewing it as a solution.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's getting on a stage and talking to 1,000, 2,000 people about the COVID crisis and how that's affecting foster youth, because vulnerable youth are always at home, parents are out of a job, people are more in poverty than they usually are. Right. And no one is able to see the abuse that's happening because kids aren't going to school or youth groups. It looks different. Sometimes it looks like a podcast with Mr. Blandford.
I love it. I think that's great. Okay. So the first time you were a part of this and you held up the sign, why did you write "Stop Stereotyping Me"?
So the statistics of the foster care system are very saddening. 50% of foster youth will go on to graduate from high school.
Okay.
3% will go on to graduate to get a bachelor's degree or higher.
3%?
3%. Mm-hmm.
Wow.
I think it's like 25% will end up either dead or incarcerated by the age of 21 years old. So the statistics really are saddening. And because of them, foster youth are often criminalized. I've started to get this less because I probably talk about it on every single podcast. But very often growing up, I would tell people that I grew up in the foster care system and they'd say, "Wow, you don't even look like a foster kid." And it's like, oh, there are just stereotypes, what? You know, all over that saying, like, what does it mean to look like a foster kid? You're saying right. that because I'm doing well for myself, that I don't right. look like a foster kid. And that's not a good thing to say, because we have already painted a picture in our mind of what these foster youth, what these vulnerable youth look like. And there's a psychological phenomenon called stereotype threat. And I spent the summer of 2016 studying and researching this phenomenon. And it basically says that, and it proves, there's been hundreds of studies. It proves and shows that when a group, especially a vulnerable group or a marginalized group, is a negative stereotype is placed upon them, it's very likely that they are going to fall into that stereotype.
Right.
So where we see it the most is Black men in education, white men in athletics. But we also see it, of course, I did that study because I wanted to see how it affected those in the foster care system. And so I didn't know that when I didn't know about this phenomenon when I wrote my sign, but I did know that the stereotypes that people placed upon me did have an influence on me, and that they hurt me, that I always felt like I was fighting really hard against them. And it like wasn't so much when I was in foster care, it didn't feel like I was fighting against the trauma as much as I felt like I was fighting against the ideas that people had about me before they even got to know me.
Yeah, totally. That makes a lot of sense. And I love like you bringing up those statistics. I don't love you bringing up those statistics. Those are hurtful statistics. Those because even if you age out in the foster care system, there are scholarships for like college and stuff, right? I mean, there's not like you can go to state schools. Is that right?
Yeah. So it's different in every state.
Okay.
I can tell you what it's like in Ohio. Okay, sure. That's where I grew up. So if you go to a public university, one that receives the FAFSA, you will receive like the biggest grant that FAFSA has to offer, as long as you were in the foster care system before the age of 16 years old.
Okay.
That's kind of like that's the box you have to check on the paper. And usually if you have good grades, if you're an athlete of some sort, you can usually get a scholarship. And there are a lot of colleges who are starting scholarships for foster youth. So there was a school that I was looking at while I was college searching, and they offered a full tuition scholarship to one foster youth a year. And my husband and I just started a scholarship, and it just got funded enough.
I saw that. So congratulations. Excited. That's super
just
exciting.
Last week, we found out that it was funded
so
enough
cool.
To offer to a foster youth or adopted youth. But yeah, we just started a scholarship, and it's going to be offered to one foster youth per year, and it's going to support them financially throughout their time in college. So I think that there are a lot of opportunities. I think the 3% is the 3%, because I don't think, like, for me, while I was in care, no one helped me find those resources. No one guided me through, like, what is the FAFSA? What are the best colleges to go to? I had to do all the Googling and researching myself.
Yeah.
And I think it can be really discouraging. It's almost like going back to the counselor thing. Like, it can be really hard to find a counselor, right? It was almost the same thing. Like, you're searching, and it can be really discouraging because there's so much. There's so many colleges and so many options, and they all have their different missions, and they all cost a lot, but they all cost different amounts. And so trying to navigate all of that when you're 18 years old, and then people are telling you you're going to go into debt, and, like, you come from poverty, probably. Right. It's like, what does this all mean? What do I do with this? And no one is, like, holding my hand throughout it all.
Yeah, the odds are stacked against you, for sure. So how many placements were you in that second time through the foster care system?
The second time I was in 11, because I was in 12 total, and the first one was just one. So
And how many years were you in 11 placements?
So that was 5. I moved an average of every 6 months. But there were some placements that only lasted, like, a week. But then there was... I think my longest placement was the group home, and that was a little bit over a year. And then my second longest placement was, I think it was like 10 months. And then after that 10 month one, I moved quite a lot.
So what did moving look like for you?
It was usually pretty abrupt. Like, you just put all of your stuff in a trash bag, or if I had a suitcase at the time, during the later moves, I finally got suitcases. You put all your stuff in your bags, and usually a caseworker comes and picks you up. Sometimes the caseworker just comes, like, there's no warning, and she's like, you gotta leave. And you just go. It's usually pretty abrupt.
Yeah.
I had a friend from college come and stay with us for the week, and she flew in, she flew out, we drove her to the airport. And I told her, I was like, I think overall I'm a pretty emotionally intelligent person, but I'm really awkward when it comes to goodbyes. Like, I'm really bad at goodbyes. I was like, I need a trash bag, and I need you to just say bye. I'm leaving, because this is too much for me. I'm not used to this. And I totally think that has to do with the foster care system, because goodbyes are always like, oh, and, like, I'm in the Midwest. So, you know, there's the Midwest goodbye, and everybody loves to take forever. They hug like 10 times. I'm like weeping by the third hug. I'm like, this is too much, guys.
Right. Yeah, that's a lot of emotional energy to put into a goodbye, for sure.
Yeah.
Oh, no doubt. Yeah. Yeah. My wife worked in the foster care system for a while. She was placement, and it just, it's pretty staggering what these kids have to go through. You know, it's just, it's hard. Like, you couldn't stack chips against them more. Like, let's just uproot you from any sort of permanence you could ever possibly feel, you know? And I'm sure there's that, like, is the caseworker sort of showing up anytime, you know, like, mm-hmm. in the back of your mind, you know? Yeah.
Oh yeah, for sure. I wrote a poem. It was like last November, but I finally shared it probably 2 or 3 weeks ago. And I just talk about what it's like moving home to home, and how you're just adjusting to every family. You're trying your best not to get kicked out, trying your best to just fit into day-to-day family dynamics. And there was definitely always this idea, like I would say that one of the, I did that for many reasons. Like, you know, you want to be accepted, you want to be loved, you just want things to go well and you don't want to disrupt another placement.
Right.
But I also did it because there was this thing always in the back of my head, this idea of when am I going to move and how can I prevent it?
Right. Yeah. I can't imagine. I honestly can't imagine. Okay. So one of the things that we've run into is, as my wife and I have sort of navigated this adoption and foster care world, we'll go to conferences and stuff and talk to people sort of wanting to get in. You know, you mentioned you sat with women sort of seeing that as an option. And so what we've found is that there's sort of like adoption's expensive, like very expensive, right? Mm-hmm. If you go that route from, you know, birth,
just out from of an adoption agency.
Yeah,
yeah, that's right. Something that people, I think maybe that's just something we should mention, because people that I often talk to, they either look at the foster care system as like, this is a way to adopt. And right. It's like, well, it is. But the foster care system's main goal is to help biological parents and then reunify
right.
their children, like the children with their biological parents. And then, or I get like the idea that foster care and adoption are the same exact thing. And actually, like adoption agencies typically do, so like they solely do adoption,
right.
And you can usually adopt young children right away if you pay a lot of money.
Yeah.
And then the foster care system is typically, and adoption usually is a long process too, mm-hmm. but the foster care system is usually a long process because you're waiting for biological parents to make a decision or not make a decision.
Yeah. Well, and yeah, I mean, that's what, yeah, you bump up against that all the time, because it's like basically the foster care system's the cheap way to adopt or something. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? And like, it's real dangerous to view the foster care system that way. But I think it's prevalent in our society.
I get messages on Instagram all the time asking me different questions. And just the other day, a sweet mom reached out to me and she said, we haven't gotten our son yet. Like, he hasn't lived with us yet, but we're going to adopt him in 90. He gets placed with us tomorrow, and then we're going to adopt him in 90 days. And I was like, oh, my heart just like sunk. Cause you know, you don't want to be discouraging. I want to walk alongside these parents and I want to be prayerful with them. And I want to be an encouragement to them. That's why I do what I do. Aside from the youth, like I want to be an encouragement to these foster parents so that they stick with it and they can love these youth well. But I was like, oh, she hasn't even met this boy yet. He hasn't been placed in her home. And she's banking on a 90-day adoption. You know, I'm like, this mom is probably going to have her heart broken, because I've seen it happen so often when the dad or a family member who wasn't in the picture comes on the 89th day and signs the paper that they want custody. And it's always a surprise. It's always a surprise to people. And it shouldn't be, because I'm like, that's actually what foster care is.
And that's the goal, like, right? I mean, that's foster care is meant for reunifying children to their biological parents. That is like the goal of foster care. And I think so many people get into foster care and start, like I said earlier, vilifying that birth parent and start working actively against them through the reunification process, which is very, very dangerous, I think, and not good for especially the child, but not good for anybody in that situation.
The foster parents that pushed to me, that encouraged me to have a good relationship with my mom, were the foster parents that I had the best relationship with.
Right And it's hard, right? I mean, I'm sure your mom had her struggles, and like, it wasn't always easy for those foster parents to facilitate
that. She was not a walk in the park. She gave my foster parents a hard time all the time. Sure. She was like, you are not her parent. She always said that. You are not her parent.
And I mean, that shows how fiercely she loves you, you know, and, but yeah, it's hard. And, when we talk about this sort of stuff, it's just like, I want people to understand the goal. And there are children in the foster care system that are available for adoption. You know, in certain states have, you know, kids who have already been, rights have been terminated, that sort of thing. There is that, but you're usually looking at a much older child, right? You're not getting mm-hmm. a baby in that situation. Mm-hmm. And you're looking at 12 years or 13 years of being in that foster care system and having placement after placement and trauma after trauma, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And let's talk about that. Like, we need foster parents who want to adopt older kids. I know that babies are really cute. I have one. Right. And my husband and I have fostered a teenager. And I love that teenage boy. But yeah, my baby's cuter. and my baby does not talk back to me, which is really nice.
Right.
So yeah. I get it. But there has to be people who are willing to step into life with teenagers. And teenagers do want to be adopted. I think people just assume that. I went into the foster care system when I was 12, as I said. And I think people just assume like, oh, they're older. They don't want to be adopted. They're going to college soon. And there's this idea that if a child is adopted, they won't be able to get college paid for. That's not true. If it's that box that you mark is, were you in foster care before the age of 16? Before the age of 16. So yeah, youth need stable parents. And I think especially when you show a teenager that like you want to stick it out for the long run, I think that's going to reduce a lot of the behaviors that teenagers can have, because that's what they're seeking. They're wondering like, how much is this person gonna put up? I know I did. I'm like, how much is this person really gonna put up with? Like, how much do they really want me? How much are they gonna chase me?
Yeah.
And my dad, the man who took me in, I still like, our relationship sounds really sweet when I'm like, oh, he walked me down the aisle and he's a great track coach, blah 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 blah. But we definitely had our struggles. We had times when we yelled at each other, when we fought, when I said that I was leaving and I slammed the door. But I know the thing that has kept our relationship so strong is that he just fights relentlessly for me. He will, like, I remember the first time I was like, I'm leaving. And I walked out and he started crying. And I was like, oh, okay. Like, that actually hurts him. I probably shouldn't say that. Hmm. Versus like telling a foster parent, I don't want to be here, I'm leaving. And then them saying, go ahead.
Right. Yeah.
It makes a big difference.
Yeah. We all want permanence, right? We all want somebody to just like love us and like fight for us. And like, that's not too much to ask, you know?
Hmm. Yeah. Yes. We just all want stability, security, all the things.
Amen.
All those things that God offers us. We just want to find, we're just seeking heaven on earth. That's what it is.
That's, yeah, you're right. You're exactly right. That's good stuff. Tori. I love it. I think this stuff has our heart, you know, and I think it's really important. If you're uncomfortable talking about this, that's totally fine. But I wonder how just your story has changed now in light of having your own, not only foster son that you have had in the house, but also just a biological baby. You know, how has that sort of changed for you?
Yeah, well, sometimes I get really scared because I can see there are ways I'm like my mom, you know, in my marriage, in my mothering. And that can be scary because she causes me so much pain. And I don't want my kids to suffer the pain that I did. And that's just being volatile, like with my words, just not thinking before I speak, not being slow to speak or slow to anger. And it's like, oh, like that was a glimpse. Like if that would have just been a little louder, or if that would have been, that tone would have been a little harsher, that would have been a glimpse of like my mom very clearly. So things like that can be really scary.
Right.
But then there's also the flip side of there's always this openness to learn, to grow as a mom and a wife. I don't ever really find myself stuck in like a belief of this is exactly what my kid needs. And growing up, I think one of my mom's struggles was that she really cared about my behavior. She really wanted to look good as a mom. And I think that I do want my kids to have good behavior, I know that that stems from a posture of the heart. And so I feel like I just want to love my children well.
Yeah.
I want to shepherd them well. And I just want to kick them towards the Lord, because I know that that's what's going to manifest the behaviors that every mom wants in their child. And I think that's the part that my mom was missing. It was that she was trying to seek results that only the Lord, that only like when God dwells in us, do they manifest. And I see that now as an adult person in my wifehood, in my motherhood, because it's the most challenging thing I've ever done, probably, in terms of, you know, wanting to be consistently good, wanting to consistently exemplify Christ. When, as I'm walking this out, I know that I couldn't be good. I couldn't make those small choices that really matter in marriage and that really matter in motherhood if it wasn't for the love of God in me.
Amen. That's awesome. I love that. Thanks for talking a little bit about that. I appreciate it. So, do you mind just telling everybody like where the best places are to kind of find you and, your space?
Yes. Yeah. I am on Instagram under Tori Hope Peterson, TORIHOPEPETERSEN, not ON. Yeah, everyone always spells my last name wrong. And we named our son, so my son's name is Leander. And we made that name up. And I feel a little bit bad for him now because of we were married for a very short time when we had our son. So the last name thing, I didn't realize it was that big of a deal. Like everyone spells it. And I wasn't very much into speaking and writing, so I wasn't giving anyone else the responsibility of spelling my last name either. Right. And now that a lot of people are responsible for spelling my last name, they pretty much always get it wrong. And I just feel bad for my son because he has this really complicated first name and then everyone's going to spell his last name wrong. And then you can find me at ToriHopePeterson.com. S-E-N.
I love it. Yeah. That's great. I've really enjoyed the blog, like I said, I think before we started, but like some like just really insightful stuff on the blog there. And yeah, good stuff. I love it. So, well, are you ready to jump into the final two questions then?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, awesome. So my first question is, what is the strangest job that you have ever had?
Strangest. Let me think. I've had a lot of jobs. Okay, I'm going to say this one because I don't think a lot of people probably haven't done it. Like I've worked in a factory. I've been a waitress. Those are all things that like people have probably done.
Yeah.
But last summer, me and my husband, we just always pick up like odds and ends jobs. We like working. And we especially like doing it if we can spend time together while working. So there is a vineyard in our community here in our town. And we are friends with someone who owns part of it. And they're getting older. So they asked my husband to mow because it's like rows and rows. So you have to do the push mower and you have to go in between. You have to be really detailed. You can't do a riding lawnmower. Sure. And then they asked me to pick the grapes. So while my husband mowed, I picked the grapes. And then we had our son who couldn't walk at the time. So we just like sat him in each row every time we moved. And it was a lot of fun.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
I love that. That's a sweet job. And like, there's so few jobs you get to do together, right? Like as a couple.
Yeah. And it was beautiful. You know, you're like in this vineyard,
right?
And it's outside. So it was really peaceful. Really nice.
That's cool. I love that. That's awesome. Okay. So my final question is, what is one piece of advice you would give to somebody looking to bring God's kingdom more into their work?
I always say this on like every podcast, but I feel like it's what moves my heart to do what I do, to continue when I feel like giving up, when I get discouraged, when the trauma feels big after telling the story. And that's do the next thing in love, whatever that looks like. I think that sometimes we think that we have to go to a third world country to do the next thing in love. Sometimes we think that we have to get on an airplane and do the next big thing or be on a stage. But it starts right where we are in our backyards, at our kitchen tables. And when you say the word work, like our most important work is the kingdom of heaven. Our most important Amen. Work is to glorify God. So just start with what you have, where you are, because when we do that, God always multiplies it. And I believe that we always end up where we're supposed to be.
Mm, truly. That's great stuff. That's awesome. I love it. Well, Tori, thank you so much for coming on and making time for me, even, you know, with your child still sleeping. I know this is precious time. So I can tell you, I appreciate that very much. So
no, that's the best time to do it. It's all good. Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure. It was an honor.
Well, I hope you enjoyed hearing from Tori. I hope this just kind of moves you along in the foster care world. Again, if you are wanting to learn more about adoption, foster care, the Replanted Conference is seriously an awesome place to do that. Go to replantedconference.org. You can sign up there for free. You'll get an email and you'll get access to just a ton of amazing resources for the month of October. So make sure and check all that out, and make sure you're following Tori just to stay up to date with what she's gotten. Just some awesome stuff on her site. And yeah, this is a great time to scroll to the bottom of your iTunes app. You can leave a rating and review there for the podcast. It just helps get the word out about the podcast. I greatly appreciate that. And until next time, get out there and hustle.